You've told us many times, and you said again today, that you think a 2015 rate hike would be a mistake.
Given my current outlook.
Given your current outlook, it looks like nearly all of your colleagues disagree with you. So what is it your, do you think that if a rate hike happens, that this will spell disaster? I mean, what, how bad will it be? I mean, is it just, I mean, you say it's a mistake, but.
Yeah, no, it's a balance of risks. You know, I think I was asked about this kind of thing earlier, and I think it's just a risk you're creating to the economy and to in particular the pursuit of the inflation target, but to the real economy as well, by moving too early. Risks don't necessarily manifest, so things could go okay, but you're creating a risk of further declines in where market-based inflation expectations are, basically to the credibility of our inflation target. And I think you're creating downside risks to our pursuit of our employment mandates I talked through today, that it would take us even longer to get back to max employment than it already has. It's just, I think weighing the balance of risks has led me to say that I would not be in favor or supportive of a rate hike in 2015, given the way I'm currently reading the data.
Is this, though, a matter of active debate at the FOMC? Or, I mean, it seems that you and maybe Charlie Evans are the only one who are.
Well, I mean, the March, you'll have to wait for June, I guess, because in the March summary of economic projections, your characterization is roughly consistent with that, right? That without naming names, we see two participants who talked about 2016 being the appropriate time frame. That's also what I've talked about in my speech, and then fifth, the others were all talked about 2015 as being appropriate. I don't know what active – anyways, that's the characterization, and we'll have to see how things play out as we go forward. I think that, the data on the real side of the economy, economic activity has been more sluggish in the first quarter and even in the second quarter than I anticipated, and I think others would say the same.
So you published that paper in January about the market-based probabilities, and one of the things I noticed on the Minneapolis Fed website is that, you know, the inflation expectation series have bounced back quite a bit after a bit of a scare at the beginning of the year. So how do you interpret that?
I don't know if I would say bounce back quite a bit. I think that they're not as low as they were at the very beginning of the year. They remain very low relative to they were, say, about a year ago, low by historical standards. I think the risks to – I think they're still telling us the same message, which is the committee's failure to provide additional accommodation and, in fact, active consideration of removal of accommodation in the face of ongoing low inflation is creating doubts about what – our inflation objectives really is.
Okay.
And that's a message I talked about last year when I was dissenting, and I think it's broadly consistent with the behavior of those series even now.
You didn't mention inflation expectations in your speech, and I was wondering if you still think, you know, that low inflation expectations create a downside risk to actual real activity.
It does, because lower inflation expectations translates into a higher real rate of interest, which is a drag on economic activity. It also means that not having anchored inflation expectations just makes monetary policy less effective when you're trying to combat adverse shocks. So all of this translates into, I think, concerns. That data does represent concerns for monetary policy. No, today, as I have last two or three times I've spoken, I've emphasized that we can do better on the labor market. But all of this is, I have a paragraph in my speech today which I think tells the message right. It doesn't matter if you're looking at inflation. It doesn't matter if you're looking at employment. We're several years, let's say three to use a number, away from where we want to be. That is not a time to removing accommodation.
It does sound, though, for the labor market, you are, or at least you see yourself as setting your sights higher than the rest of the committee for where the labor market should be. I wonder, how does that conversation play itself out if you think about, is it really just a conversation between pessimists and optimists? Is it a conversation between those who believe we're stagnating, perhaps, and those who think?
You know, I think my colleagues have spoken about their positions quite frequently. I think that in terms of my own perspectives, I'm very much driven by what's happening with inflation. As long as inflation remains low, I'm not really that worried. I don't sit at home and worry, boy, the FOMC is creating too many jobs. What are we going to do about it? You know, that is not the concern that I have. And so as long as inflation remains where I see it, where private sector forecasters see it, where public sector forecasters, like our own board staff, see it, we can do more to help the labor market. And that's consistent with what I was trying to say today. There are uncertainties about where we can get to in the labor market. You know, I gave some simple extrapolations today. There's absolutely uncertainties about that. Can we do better? Absolutely. That part I feel very confident about. Mm-hmm.
But as for the recent sort of strengthening of inflation measures, do you?
Yeah, I think, we're starting to see a little bit of hardening maybe in CPI core. I want to wait and see what's happening with the personal consumption expenditure and the PCE inflation side. You know, there's obviously some discrepancies between those two. You know, it's not about the next last 3 months of data, Ann. It's really about where inflation is going to be going over the next several years. And the last 3 months is not. I'm going to need to see more information before I would, you know, change my perspective on that materially.
Where would you set the Fed funds rate today, based on your outlook, if the zero lower bound wasn't binding?
I haven't thought about that question. But I would say that it would be lower than it is today.
Okay.
But I haven't thought about that coherently enough. And it's somewhat related to the question that was asked in the audience. Part of it is just about, boy, if you could do it and you suddenly did it, that by itself would just be starting to send real strong messages. But I don't have I'd certainly be willing to set it lower.
Sure. And do you sort of like quantify the impact of a global output gap, global slack on U.S. inflation? And does that present a challenge for you as a
I guess the straight answer to your question is no. Our modeling of inflation doesn't include those kinds of factors. Richer models maybe should. The general message, I think, is that output gaps don't have a lot of predictive value for future inflation. They'd matter, but not very much. Some research that was done at our bank in the late 90s by Andrew Akison and Leo Haney, and I think was the first to pick this up, but it's been replicated many, many times, that measures of real activity like unemployment, output gaps, do matter for the future course inflation, but they don't matter all that materially. I think weakness overseas ends up translating into having a stronger U.S. dollar if you have weak demand conditions overseas, and that creates downward pressure on our inflation, and that's definitely something that you have to take into account. But again, if you're looking over a 2 to 3 year outlook, this is probably not something that's going to show up there.
Since you can't set the rate lower, as you said you would actually rather like to, the only thing you can do is just leave rates low for a longer time?
You can leave rates low, but communicate about why you're leaving them low. It's not just leaving them low for a longer period of time. It's about saying what you're trying to achieve by leaving them low, what the destination is. So my research director, Sam Schulhofer-Wohl, wrote the essay for our annual report this year. I thought that was very important points that It's not about saying, you know, you and I always have this conversation about 2015 or 2016. It's not really about that. It's about where are we trying to get to and why are we taking the steps in order to facilitate that. I think that's really really critical. What I'm saying to you is I see inflation taking 3 years to get back to target. I'm not using words like it's moving slowly back or it's vague what we have in the statement. What I'm saying is, for myself, It's going to take, under current policy, it's going to take 3 years to get back to target. That's not acceptable. We've got to move faster. We've got to do more. Mm-hmm. So, or leave rates at least, not do less.
It seems like there's been a lot of rise in activity and, you know, peer-to-peer lending and a lot of this financial innovation stuff. Is there any concern about, you know, the Fed's ability to, you know, sort of control the monetary policy transmission mechanism in that environment and, you know, sort of track those activities more generally?
You know, I think we're in much better shape. We're not in perfect shape, absolutely, in terms of our ability to monitor financial stability considerations and conditions. But we're in much better shape than we were 8 years ago, 9 years ago, I guess now. I mean, I think you go back to 2006, people had some of these concerns in their mind, but didn't have the information. But we just have a lot of our best people in the system spend a lot of time trying to analyze that, these kinds of issues. And for me, as a monetary policymaker, the question is, how does this influence my desire or willingness to influence the stance of policy? And at this stage, I don't see a concern that's sufficient to make me want to change my policy recommendation.
Okay. And one other thing I really wanted to ask you, because a lot of people seem to be wondering, why aren't you seeking reappointment when your term ends?
Oh, I've enjoyed this job considerably. It was a great experience for me. And tremendous opportunity to serve the public and learn and do engage with public as I did today, and also in engage in policy work. But it just seems like for me, it just felt like the right time to move on to new opportunities.
Any idea what those might be?
Not at this stage, but okay. In the spirit of transparency, I'll certainly keep the media okay. Posted.
I appreciate it.
Maybe you won't need such a big winter coat wherever you go next.
We'll have to wait and see.
GDP, nominal GDP targeting, this is something that comes up from time to time. And actually, Jim Bullard published a paper. It was a working paper that he talked at length about this morning, saying this would be a better approach.
Wow. Okay, you're ahead of me. I have not had a chance to read Jim's paper.
He said forward guidance on rates doesn't work. He said quantitative easing is, question mark around there, but nominal GDP targeting, that's the thing.
Well, I look forward to reading Jim's paper. It's interesting.
Do you have a view, though, on, it's not, the idea is not a new one. You don't have to read his paper to have a view.
No, I think that we've taken a stance on inflation targeting as being how we interpret the price stability mandate, how we interpret the employment, and then we use labor market metrics of a variety of kinds to track the employment mandate. I've always been concerned in the past by a nominal GDP target, if you had a real slowdown, persistent slowdown in productivity growth, that could translate into relatively high inflation for relatively long periods of time. Mm-hmm. And then how does that translate into movements in inflation expectations? Mm-hmm. But maybe Jim has some good arguments about that I haven't read. So I would certainly view myself as being in the learning mode on that more than anything else. So.
I'd be interested to know what you think when you read that. And I did want to ask you actually about productivity.
Yeah.
And how where do you stand on that? You know, how are you viewing the debate over whether it's we're at a new normal, so to speak.
I'll say a couple things about that. First of all, the evidence I've seen seems to suggest that productivity is very hard to predict. So that the last 6 years or last 10 years doesn't tell you very much about what's going to happen the next 10 years in terms of productivity growth. So that's one comment. Another comment is I've been influenced in thinking about the 1930s in a big way here. We had a very dramatic fall in labor productivity and total factor productivity at the beginning of the 1930s, before President Roosevelt came into office. And then after that, we had one of the fastest increases in productivity, one of the fastest rates of productivity growth in U.S. history took place in his first term. So what is it? What do you take away from that? There's a number, as is often with economists, there's a lot of debates about that. But my own perspective is that improvement in demand prospects can lead to improvements in productivity growth. And the reason is that productivity growth is not exogenous to the economy. It's based on decisions made by firms to invest in research and development. And what makes them do that is the prospects of getting customers when they do that. So I think that there's more interaction between providing sufficient accommodation to facilitate rapid improvements in labor market outcomes and in economic activity and productivity growth than is usually countenanced. So those are my two comments. One is it's hard to predict. That's cheap. Everyone will say that. But the other piece is I think we have to be cautious. It's another reason to be cautious about removing accommodation is that our inability to lower rates as much as I would like, I think, is partly responsible for the slow growth in productivity that we've seen.
Now, you mentioned the dollar, and I was just sort of wondering, so it seems like every time the Fed is getting close, like, in the first couple months of this year and the end of 2014, to a rate hike, the dollar strengthens, takes a big chunk out of the economy, and then after the March meeting, we saw the dollar fall again, the dots came down, the curve starts steepening again, all of this sort of thing. So how do you avoid, as you get closer and closer to a rate hike, you know, that dollar appreciation coming back and taking a chunk out of the economy and pushing you back further?
That's what tightening policy is about. Presumably that's what you want when you tighten policy, is to take a chunk out of the economy. Why else would you do it? That's what you're trying to achieve when you raise rates, is to take a chunk out of economic activity. Why else would you raise rates? You're raising rates because you think economic activity is too high in America, and you think that we should have lower prices, lower and not as fast a rate of increase in employment as we would otherwise have. Part of that is driven by the dollar, but it's a sign of what you want when you raise rates. So it's not an accident. It is part of policy, and you're going to have to live with that about raising rates.
What about this, though? I mean, you said raising rates means you think economic activity is too high. I think some people would say that you expect economic activity to be too high in 18 to 24 months.
That's a fair gloss.
But just to sort of take that one more further. People like to look at historical points of reference to say, well, this is, you know, my cautionary moment. And I've heard 1965 referenced as a time when there was low inflation and unemployment was very low, and there was a, you know, big debate what to do at the Fed over raising rates. And you know, within a year, inflation was, you know, quite high. So things really turned around.
Yeah, capacity utilization was over 90%, something worth checking out.
Okay.
it's an interesting time frame to look at. I think that the Fed, my own reading of that is the Fed did get enough warning signs to raise rates, but they were cautious about doing so, even after inflation. I think the thing to be careful about is to say the mistakes in the mid-60s immediately translated to where we found ourselves in 1979. There were a lot of times to get off the a lot of floors to get off the elevator, as it were, and I've read a lot of these same transcripts and looked through them, and you know, my own takeaway from this is you really want to be cautious about Phillips curve reasoning when you're watching inflation. They were counting on the idea that lower economic activity would be a drag on inflation, significant drag on inflation. Didn't happen as much as they thought. And I think we should be careful in thinking that low unemployment, high real activity is going to be a stimulant to higher inflation. And I worry that some of the outlooks that I see people talk about are being driven too much by that Phillips curve thinking. So it's sort of the 1960s mistake in reverse, I worry about.
What do you think of the 1937 analog? Do you think that's apt? I mean, is there a risk that if you go in 2015, say, that you're going to find yourself back at the zero lower bound?
Oh, I think that, so I'll say two things. I mean, 1937 is a very dramatic analog, and I would call that a risk as opposed to my benchmark outlook if we were to raise rates early. But the idea that if we raised rates that things could turn in such a way that, boy, we have a lot of we might want to turn back, or we find ourselves stuck at the same rate level for a very long period of time, as was true, say, for the Bank of Canada very recently. Those are very, I think, very significant risks. The 37 one, you know, are we going to cause a recession? I mean, I'm not trying to articulate. It's more, I think we certainly create a drag on economic activity. It wouldn't be a 1937 situation, but would it be bad enough that we would find ourselves regretting having raised rates? Or feel ourselves compelled to lower rates back down to zero? I think those are very real risks. Yeah.
But now everyone keeps saying we want to raise rates, but it'll be super gradual. I mean, wouldn't the gradualness make up for raising rates?
I think the question that will transpire so on this is very similar to what happened in 2013 when the Fed started talking about reducing the rate of flow of asset purchases. So very dramatic changes in financial market conditions. I would say tightening of financial market conditions over a 3-month time frame. Why did that happen? It's because it's not the actions per se by themselves, how slow they are or whatever. It's what is making you do this? Why are you taking this step when you didn't need to take this step? You could have left rates where they are. You're signaling that your goals are not what markets thought they were, not what maybe the public thought they were more generally. If you raise rates totally hypothetically in June or September of this year with the inflation outlook that I have, you're sending the message that you're okay with taking a very long time to get back to the inflation target. That will manifest itself in a number of ways in financial market conditions.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you what is the most interesting piece of research that you've read lately and why?
Oh, man. I haven't had as much time to read research as I would like, and
But is there anything
to your earlier question?
Right. Anything that's captured your imagination particularly or made you rethink things? On some dimension or another.
Let me see. You know, it's not a paper I read recently, but I like Caballero and Farhi's paper on the safety trap quite a bit. I think it's a very interesting paper. I'm going to forget the I know what the lead author. I've forgotten the other author's name. Kinda Hatcham, who's at the University of Chicago Booth School, has a very nice paper on inflation expectations. Both of those I think are very interesting.
Did you take any lessons from those or anything like that?
I think the Hatcham paper makes it clear that it's the control of inflation expectations is a very complicated matter for central banks. And once you lose control, the process can become very complicated about how you would ever bring them back. I think that's really the lesson I would take. And so it's yet another reason to be cautious.
Okay.
Sorry, I can't let it go. I mean,
it's data dependent. I think it's no. You're answering your own question with your shirt.
Isn't it frustrating? I mean, you're looking at the same data as everyone else, and yet you're seeing an entirely different policy solution.
Yeah, I wish I had. You know, obviously, I regret my lack of persuasiveness. I mean, I think. That I think we would have better policy if I was more persuasive than I've been able to be. If I go back to September 2012, I articulated, you were there, articulated idea that we could afford to keep, we should commit to keeping rates low at least until the unemployment rate fell below 5.5%. We didn't adopt that. I wasn't able to be persuasive on that dimension. Well, here we are. Unemployment's below 5.5%, and we're still at the zero lower bound. We could have, I think, none of the awful risks that people were worried about transpired. And so I haven't been as persuasive. I wasn't persuasive then. I'm not as persuasive now. I wish I were more persuasive. I think the country would be – my own perspective is that we would be in better shape if we were able to. On the other hand, I hope they're right, and I'm wrong. you want what the economy to turn out better than I. If the committee were to adopt different policies from what I recommend, I hope that those work out better than I think they would.
That's so interesting. I had somehow forgotten that you had advocated for the 5.5 percent. Of course, we're below that.
We are.
Did you call up all your colleagues and say, told you?
I told you so as an admission of defeat, because you were not being persuasive on something that turned out to be good. Mm-hmm. I mean, admitting you were wrong about something is fine. I mean, I told you so as an admission that you failed.
Yeah, because you told them and they didn't.
Yeah.